My name's Paul Bestall. This is Mysteries and Monsters on the Paranormal UK Radio Network. Welcome back to Mysteries and Monsters. Since the show first started, one particular mystery seems to have been requested by plenty of listeners more than any other. And that mystery is Dyatlov Pass. As such, I only considered one person to discuss this case with, and that was, of course, Keith McCloskey. Keith's diligent research, investigations, and even trips to Dyatlov itself have made him the best person to discuss the case with, in my opinion. Keith has also just released a new book, Unsolved Aviation Mysteries, featuring five cases you may never have heard of, or even looked into too deeply, as well as an updated version of his last Dyatlov Pass book, and we discuss both books, as well as pondering the mysterious deaths of those nine unfortunate souls back in 1959. The links to Keith's books and his fantastic website on Dyatlov are in the show notes if you fancy falling down that particular rabbit hole. It was a real pleasure to speak to Keith at last, so I hope you enjoy this week's show. Thanks again for the lovely comments and reviews on all our social media platforms. It is always greatly appreciated. Don't forget, our merchandise shop is now available through Redbubble under Mysteries and Monsters, and thank you to everyone who's already made a purchase. Clearly, black and green mugs are very popular. You can find us across all social media platforms by searching for Mysteries and Monsters. The YouTube channel is now fully functional and updated with every show, so if you can subscribe, please do so. If nothing else, lockdown has proved to be quite a productive time for me, so I've got another couple of projects that should hopefully see the light of day for you all in the next couple of weeks. Okay, time to turn our minds to detective mode, as we ponder some perplexing mysteries in the company of Keith McCloskey. My guest today is someone I have wanted to speak to for a long time since I first saw him on TV discussing the Flannan Isles mystery. However, Keith McCloskey's reputation was cemented when he brought the infamous Dyatlov Pass incident to the West. Keith's diligence, hard work and tenacity has seen Dyatlov become one of the most well-known mysteries of the modern era, and I am delighted to welcome Keith to the show to discuss this, as well as his fantastic new book, Unsolved Aviation Mysteries, Five Strange Tales of Air and Sea. Keith, welcome to Mysteries and Monsters, sir. How are we?
Yeah, fine, thank you. Thank you for having me on, Paul. I'm glad to be here.
Hey, my absolute pleasure. So, rather fortuitously, Keith, because I know we've been looking forward to get this pinned down for a while, so I'm delighted to finally get the opportunity to speak to you, as I touched on in the introduction, both about your new book and Dyatlov.
Yep.
So, you were obviously brought up in an aviation background, I believe. I think your family worked in the airline industry, didn't they?
That's right, yeah. My dad was a pilot with Aer Lingus, and my mother was an air hostess, as we used to call them in those days. And obviously, I think a lot of sons tend to follow what their dads do, but he left the aviation industry, and so did my mother in those days when a woman got married. She had to relinquish the job. But there we went. I actually grew up in West Africa. So it wasn't long after I was born that my father went to work in Nigeria. So that's where I spent the first 12 years on and off of my life.
Yeah. I mean, it is interesting because obviously prior to your latest book, Keith, obviously, as I touched on as well, you've obviously most famous, I think, for anybody listening is obviously Dyatlov and the Flannan Isles case. So they're two books.
Yeah.
So obviously, with your background, I think the new book that you've released is probably something that I'm quite surprised that you've not turned your attentions to previously, Keith. Because obviously, with your background and your love of mysteries, as I've touched on there, is this something of a labour of love in regards to a subject you've wanted to cover for a while?
Absolutely. The thing is, I've written a number of aviation history books, tending mainly towards Scottish aviation history, but that's just something that I, you know, when we came back from West Africa, I grew up in Edinburgh. I spent my teen years in Edinburgh, so I became sort of pretty well acquainted with Scottish aviation, and it's a very specialist aviation subject, but unfortunately, whilst there is some interest in it, it's not going to knock J.K. Rowling off the top spot by any stretch of the imagination. But I've always been interested in mysteries. Mm. If I could grow another head and another pair of arms, I would be. I could rattle out book after book after book on mysteries, murder mysteries, and other mysteries. And I'll just touch on something very quickly that I've got a couple in the pipeline. Of a couple of mysteries about which will be well known to possibly to some of your listeners about two girls that died in Central America, two Dutch girls who disappeared, and eventually they found their skeletons months later. Mm. And there's two Italian girls that disappeared disappeared, I think, about 10 days apart back in the 80s, and their bodies have never been found, or no trace of them has ever been found. And they quite intrigued me because there's all sorts of theories about what happened, in particular to the Italian girls. There's rumours of the Vatican being involved and all the rest of it. One of the girls' father worked for the Vatican. But anyway, I won't go too much into that, but that's just a couple of projects in the pipeline. And but like I say, it's a huge subject. And I think what gets us all going about mysteries is you want the answer. Mm. We all want certainty, and we all want an answer of some kind. I do anyway. That's what drives me on it, I think, what possibly happened. And when you get to Dyatlov, it's... Mm. You can't explain it. It's something that drives us all mad.
I think that's half the appeal of it, though, Keith, because it's not a one-size-fits-all situation in regards to that.
It's not. But,
I think before we shoot our bolt in regards to Dyatlov, let's concentrate on this fabulous new book. So,
okay.
I mean, there are five brilliant stories in it. I mean, there are two, obviously, that jump out, which are the first story, which is about the mysterious crash of a Cessna on the Isle of Mull in the 1970s, which is one of those cases where it's almost as if you, when you're reading the story as you've compiled it, Keith, it's one of those where you start scratching your head and thinking, what on earth was this person thinking about?
Absolutely. You can imagine a young lad, say 23 years old, who probably had a couple of pints and thought he was a Spitfire ace or something, and going out and doing something stupid. But he was a mature man in his 50s, and could have possessed him to have done what he did? It's almost like a death wish to take off in a mountainous area with a couple of torches on the ground, with 5 hours bare minimum of night flying experience. It almost defies belief.
Yeah. I mean, it's one of those things. So this chap who went by the name of Peter Gibbs, because I believe Peter was his middle name, but that's the one he preferred to be known as.
That's right.
He had decided to visit the Isle of Mull in regards to, I think, was he purchasing this aeroplane that he ended up taking for a test flight, Keith?
No. He had the plane belonged to a businessman over in Oban, and they had driven up there and they'd gone over on the ferry. Mm. The thing is, it's quite a long drive. It's from if you were going to go from Glasgow, it's quite a long drive on the roads, go over on the ferry. You can fly there literally in from say Prestwick or Glasgow. You'd probably do it in about less than 30 minutes. Mm. But it's awkward to get to overland, but with a plane, it's a light plane, you can do it in no time. But he decided when they got there, him and his girlfriend had decided to hire a plane while they were there just to have a bit of a fly around, because it's quite a popular... The airstrip actually belongs to the Glen Forser Hotel up there, and it's still in use. It's quite a popular destination. People with light aircraft will fly up there for a long weekend and get a bit of flying in, and it's a lovely part of the world as well. So the plane actually didn't even belong to him. It belonged to somebody he'd hired it off.
Yeah, and it's one of those things, because this whole situation seems to just come from nowhere. I know, as you touched on, he wasn't a young chap. He was a fairly sensible, you know, he would come across as a sensible middle-aged gentleman, who, as you say, there are some discrepancies in regards to things like his license, I think, had needed
That's right,
renewing.
Yeah.
It, he hadn't,
yep.
but he'd attempted to renew it and then kind of not followed up with it.
That's right. He also needed glasses for flying when he took his medical. He took a medical, and they said that he couldn't fly without glasses, and he never used glasses for flying. And if you think at night time, if your vision's a little bit defective, you would need every... what's the word you could use, accuracy, if you like, or you needed to be able to see absolutely what you were doing, because there's so few visual references on the ground in the darkness.
Yeah, absolutely. And you know, yeah. And especially that time of year as well. I know when he takes off, it's fairly clear, which, you know, if anybody's been to Scotland, and especially the Isles, you know, in winter, they can be some ferocious locations weather-wise.
Well, he took off. That was the other thing. Anybody going up for a flight will always get usually anyway, but get a weather forecast. And although he took off and the weather was semi okay, it was a clear, it was what you would call a decent night, if you like, but there was a front coming in with snow and sleet, very, very cold front, and it was literally approaching when he took off. So if he had just done his circuit and landed, he probably would have just missed it, but he didn't allow for anything. But he didn't even know it was coming. That was the point. He took off without checking the forecast.
Yeah. I mean, it's one of those stories where, like I said there, you're reading it and you're thinking, what on earth is this gentleman thinking of? Because it just seems to... The impression that comes across in that particular chapter, Keith, is he didn't seem like a very risky chap. He didn't seem to be the type of person to take... unnecessary risks in life, it would seem. He didn't seem to have a reputation of being that kind of type of person.
No, well, he was an accomplished violin player. I'll put in the he played for orchestras. He had his own violin quartet, I think it was. And could you think of a man in his 50s who played, you know, was an accomplished violin player, wouldn't strike you as some sort of headbanger that wanted to go out and get pissed out of his head and attack everybody in the high street. But he was doing almost the equivalent by doing what he did. It was something totally reckless and, well, beyond stupid, putting his life at risk, damaging with the possibility of crashing somebody else's plane. None of it makes any sense, the behaviour.
It's almost as if it's as if he just seemed to have some kind of episode, as you know. I'm not, you know, I know you don't allude to that, Keith, but it's the behaviour is so out of character. The situation is so unusual. I think they'd had dinner, he'd had a couple of drinks. He hadn't had a lot to drink, from what I can gather. So we can't even kind of, you know, as we've touched on there, we can't kind of look at alcoholic bravado taking over, or even the fact to show off, because there was nobody there to impress. You know, he was there with his partner of the time. There was hardly anybody at the hotel at that time of year. There wasn't an audience to impress. So
that's right.
You know, he decides to take this plane for a flight. And obviously it's a local airport. It obviously isn't designed to take incoming flights at night, because obviously they had to utilize what they had there, which is why he ended up, I think, was it Felicity ends up marking the runway with a pair of torches, or
two handheld torches was what was to guide him. But when he took off, he made a right turn, then made another right turn. It was just a basic circuit. to come back and land on what was just about a grass runway by the sea. But when he made his right turn on the base leg to come back in to turn into land, he disappeared behind trees, and he would have lost sight of the torches, which is probably, again, this is just conjecture, but he must have lost sight of them, and it would have been pitch black, and he wouldn't have seen anything. So he must have got disorientated, but he would have known his height, and the sensible thing to do would have been to have turned right again and gone out over the sound to see if he could pick up the torches again. But from what it looks like is he must have got confused, brought the Cessna down far too low and gone in the water.
Yeah. I mean, this start of the situation is strange enough. You know, this whole situation, none of it makes sense. There doesn't seem to be any reason for it. And yet, the beginning of the story is probably the least mysterious aspect of this whole scenario, because from that point on, this case takes a very strange turn, doesn't it?
It does, yes. What happened was, after he disappeared, the weather, the front had come in, and it was sleet and snow. It was very cold. They did a preliminary search. The police were called, and they had a look around, and there was obviously no sign of the aircraft. And the event, you know, eventually they got the RAF Kinloss Mountain Rescue Team down, and all the surrounding mountains were, you know, there were large hills, small mountains, if you like, but they searched those fairly thoroughly. There was a forest that they didn't go too deeply into because it was so thick, naval helicopters were brought in. A couple of naval minesweepers eventually came in a good while later and had a look, but there was literally no sign of it. So it brought up all sorts of theories as to what he'd done. There was talk of him working for MI5 and going to that he'd flown to Northern Ireland to meet paramilitaries. But you think, that leads on to the next thing, when his body was discovered 4 months later on near the top of a hill, about less than a mile from the hotel.
Yeah.
So it looked as if his body had got there, because it was in a state of decomposition, but there wasn't a mark on his body. That was the other. There was a small cut on his leg, on the front of his leg, I think. Yeah. But even that hadn't been caused by any crash. When they looked at it, the autopsy. Nobody could explain how his body had got there. Half a mile to three quarters of a mile up a hill.
Yeah, I mean, it is perplexing, because you've got this aspect of it that he seemingly survived this crash.
Yes. Yep.
The wreckage of the plane wasn't discovered. There doesn't seem to be any kind of explanation as to how he ends up here on this particular hill.
Yep.
The plane, as you say, goes down, from what people gather, at sea. And I know when they were doing the autopsy and the inquiry in regards to his body, that one of the perplexing questions was, there seemed to be a distinct lack of salt on his clothing.
That's right.
which
yeah.
didn't kind of support him crashing into the sea. Yet we've got no plane and a body halfway up a hill.
Yeah, with no seawater on it. Yeah.
It's remarkable, because then that kind of makes you think, well, even if the plane crashed, to surmise that someone crashing at night in the sea off an island off the coast of Scotland in winter and then getting up, it's just remarkable, because every aspect of this case seems to disprove any potential theory you might have. Because, well, if he's crashed in the sea, I mean, how anybody could crash a small plane into the sea at night, get out, swim to shore, and then make their way up a mountain with virtually no injuries seems...
Exactly, yeah.
It's remarkable, Keith.
Yeah, and not only that, but swim to shore. You think, what it's like getting in the swimming baths in the summer. It's cold enough, but it's the middle of it's December, it's Christmas Eve in December, freezing cold winter water. So even the shock of getting into it would be enough to jolt your system, especially for somebody who wasn't a young man.
Yeah.
And then swim ashore in all his clothes, and then later on, for there to be no salt water, you could argue that in the time the body was there, that rain may have washed the salt away. But what the autopsy brought out was that the watch he was wearing, they would have expected to find traces of salt water within the mechanism, and there wasn't any. There was none inside the boot, which you would expect. So there's no real explanation for it. And apart from the other thing about the body being found on top of a hill, if he had crashed in the water, is he would have had to have crossed the road to the hotel, because the road followed the coast, and just barely a quarter of a mile away along is the hotel.
Mm.
So why not follow the road rather than go up a small mountain or a big hill? But you'd think that most people would think, well, if I stay on the road, a car might come along, or I might come to a house. You know, you don't start wandering into the wilderness, do you?
No, absolutely. I mean, that once again, though, would tend, because as I'm sure you're aware, Keith, we've come across many a perplexing mystery of hikers and things who get lost, and obviously hypothermia sets in, and
yes,
sometimes that can make the brain do very strange things. Yet, for him to ignore all these signs and help, essentially, adds another layer of mystery to it, because it's almost as if he didn't want to save himself. It was almost as if he was walking away from help.
That's true. That's certainly true. Yes. Again, it's just guesswork, but could it have been that he wanted to prove to himself that he was still at the top of his game in flying? He obviously, the crash of the aircraft and him losing his way proved that he wasn't. I mean, could it have been that he was so ashamed of what he'd done that he tried to prove it? Because remember, he was used to fly Spitfires in the war, so that he wasn't the hotshot top of his game pilot he thought he was, and that the shame of it was too much, and that he just wandered off to die. But again, it's just guessing.
Yes, it is. It is. And it's one of those that, obviously, regardless, you know, the body turns up 4 months later, and yet the plane, no one can seem to pinpoint it. And then I think it's what, 11 years later, we then get allegations of the plane being discovered, which then causes even more controversy.
That's right. Well, there was... A diver called Richard Grieve and his brother were diving for clams in just off the coast, and he came across the remains of what he said was the Cessna, and he took 28 pictures with his underwater camera, which he sent to me, and I'll publish them in the book. And to me, it's quite clearly G-A VTN, which was the registration of the Cessna. Some people have disputed it and said that you can't be sure until you see the actual wreckage, bring it up to see what caused it to crash into the sea, and there's other allegations of, well, you can do all sorts of things with with Photoshop and all the rest of it. You know, there's always some bar humbug type of person who will dispute it. You know, as the saying goes, there's always one, but they're quite clear to me. I mean, he's in one of the pictures looking inside the cockpit as well.
Yeah.
So with his aqualung, it's his scuba gear on. It's as I say, to me, it shows the plane, but that's the only. With the 28 slides, but that's the only sighting that there has been of it on the sea floor in the Sound of Mull. And the tides now and dredging for clams will have probably moved the wreckage. Even in the slides, when you see the picture in the book, you can see that it's being covered with all sorts of vegetation and seaweed and what have you. So though you would, even if you came across it now, you probably wouldn't even recognise it.
Yeah, because it is remarkable, because I think these pictures were taken, like I say, about 11 years after, and you can
they
already...
They were, yeah.
I mean, like I said to you before we joined in this conversation, we were chatting off air, Keith, and I mean, I'm looking at the pictures you published in the book, and for me, it's as clear as the nose on your face that it's clearly his plane.
It's clearly that plane. Yeah.
But there is already, as you refer to, a lot of vegetation growing on it, a lot of algae kind of already there. It looks dirty, and the registration is spotted where it's already growing over it. So I couldn't even imagine what it would look like 30 years later, even if it's still there, or even in one piece.
Yeah, that's right. Yeah. But of course, it doesn't explain his behaviour afterwards.
No. It's a remarkable, and it's a fantastic, it's one of those stories when you read it, it really gets the juices flowing, because it's one of those, because every time you think, oh, well, it's that. Because, like, obviously, when the first thing that came through my mind, Keith, when the plane disappears, you know, as you refer to, he was early 50s, not in great shape, he wasn't terribly out of shape, but he wasn't in the best of shape.
No.
You know, the potential he could have had a heart attack and whatever, and, you know, in the situation. However, that then is then disproved because his body turns up. So we have to deal with the fact of the plane in the sea and him being found on land up a hill. It's a remarkable case, and one I thank you for bringing out into the daylight, because it's a wonderful start to the book.
Yeah, I like this. The thing is, I was a bit of a plane spotter when I was a teenager in Edinburgh. I used to go out to Edinburgh Airport because that's where I've actually seen that aircraft. Well, used to see it every day.
Yes.
It used to be parked at Edinburgh Airport, and I used to watch it taxi out and take off. And part of the irony of the story, I always look for odd coincidences in stories, and the Gibbs used to help out with the University Air Squadron Air Experience flight in the hangar there at Edinburgh Airport. And the plane that was going to be involved in taking his life some years later was parked about a couple of 200 yards away, and I'm sure he would have seen it, but he had no connection to it then, and obviously that was the one which caused his death. Would have been about 7 or 8 years later, and 90 miles away. So,
yeah, it is one of those strange things that, like you say, it's one of those. Is it a coincidence? Because for him to be in the same vicinity of the plane that he would end up losing his life over is a remarkable coincidence.
Mm.
Incredible. So the other story that bookends your latest book. Yep. Is one that I was aware of, but certainly not in the depth that you've pulled all the remarkable strands of this case together, which is the disappearance of a gentleman called Alfred Lowenstein, who allegedly fell out of a plane, I think 4,000 feet above the English Channel in 1928.
That's right. Yep, that's
right. So Lowenstein's a very strange case, because I believe at the time he was probably the richest man in the world.
I would say so. He was certainly one of the richest men in the world, if not the richest man in the world. He had a lot of money, that's for sure.
I mean, yes, and he seems a remarkably switched-on gentleman, because I think for anybody to be able to achieve what he'd achieved in a period of time shows a remarkable brain and business ethic and just an extremely clever man. He certainly seemed to be able to make money without really trying. He just seemed a naturally talented person in that field.
He was. I think that's what, just going as an aside, I think people tend to overlook how clever some people are, because, you know, I've certainly thought, oh, well, look, he's quite lucky getting that. But you tend to forget that people who achieve great things like he has done, whether it's money or making some kind of patent for something, these people are generally clever. And he was a clever man, there's no doubt about it, because he brought things to ways of raising finance that hadn't been thought of before, and he had a great eye for detail. He basically lived for business and finance you might say, well, that, sounds like a pretty boring person, but whether or not he was a boring person, he, starting out from pretty basic roots, he grew to be the richest man in the world.
I mean, this whole case seems extremely peculiar, primarily because the essential aspects of the story are that this gentleman accidentally, I think the general thought of his demise was based on him taking a wrong turning after coming out of a toilet, which at first makes you start to scratch your head anyway, Keith.
Yeah.
But it's also the fact that, yes, fair enough, somebody's fallen out of a plane. However, he wasn't, obviously, there are the people piloting the plane. He had, were there half a dozen people on the plane with him, I believe?
Six,
yep. Yeah.
Yeah.
So, when this case sort of explodes, because obviously it's worldwide news, because obviously this gentleman has a lot of people relying on him in regards to the fact that he makes money. He's got a lot of companies, a lot of businesses, a lot of shareholders. His death had resonance around the world at that time, especially in the financial world.
It did, because they thought it was actually going to affect world markets, his death. But it's things stabilised about the time. But the fact that when he first, because they hadn't found his body, they didn't find his body immediately. It was assumed that he'd just disappeared. But the markets were really shaky. And he had several giant business interests, and people were wondering, well, are these going to survive his loss? Because he was obviously the driving force behind a lot of it. They were worried about the share prices plummeting, businesses going bust, and having the knock-on effect on business worldwide. He had such a strong presence, if you like, in the world financial markets.
Yeah. So, Lowenstein's taking this trip across the Channel, and I believe he was in a Fokker.
Yes, yeah.
which was quite a popular plane for private journeys at that time, Keith.
It was, and some of the airlines had them as well. Some of the European airlines, they were quite larger. I suppose you could say it was, if you like, the Boeing 737 of its day. Obviously, in the 1920s, aircraft were pretty basic, but it was a large plane, and he was comfortable with air travel. If you like, he was a pioneer in that by using aircraft for his own business purposes to get around, he saw the advantage of the time saving, and it was big enough for him to take his staff, his personal business staff with him, and his butler and his secretary. So it wasn't a small aircraft by any stretch of the imagination, but it wasn't massive either. I've put in a picture of the layout. I've put a layout, a drawing of the layout, how it was, and also there's a picture there of what it looked like as a passenger configuration. But it's still quite a compact cabin.
Yeah, it. I mean, it's one of those things, because obviously his death, it was perplexing anyway, regardless. But then when the inquiry begins into this, Keith, there seems to be, I think the general perception is that the consistent approach was that, oh, well, it was a terrible accident. But then when people tried to discuss the case and look at the evidence, things don't stack up very quickly, do they?
No, they don't. It's part of the problem, though, is where the accident happened. And then again, you wonder about that, because if he had been murdered, it was quite convenient that he got, if you like, murdered in the middle of the English Channel, where nobody would claim any jurisdiction over it from a legal point of view. The French really weren't interested. The Belgians weren't interested. And the British, I'm not saying they weren't interested in what happened, but each of the three countries were basically saying, well, we've got no jurisdiction because it happened over them, which leads you back to make you wonder if it had been planned.
Yeah, Well, it's the perfect crime, isn't it? Because it's one of those that if you are going to commit a crime, it's probably a fabulous place to do it, primarily because, you know, you're over the sea. And as you say, there seems to be a real reticence for any country to kind of grab it and say, right, we're going to deal with this.
Yeah, I think also they took it at face value that, you know, the pilot changed his story, though, that but first he said it was easy to open the door in flight. He said it wasn't easy. But then he changed his story almost a couple of days later in an interview and said that it was easy to open it and that he probably fell out. So I think nobody seemed to pick them up on the discrepancies in the stories. But I think at first when people, if you like, the authorities in all three countries looked at it, it's, oh dear, he's committed suicide, basically, because that's what was put forward first, is he's just opened the door and stepped out to his death. But there was nothing, no reason really for him to have done it. You would expect a man about to jump to his death would have massive problems of all his companies crashing down on him and all the rest of it, losing vast sums, but none of that was happening. He was actually doing quite well.
Yeah, I mean, there are discrepancies in the witness testimony all over the place, aren't there, Keith?
Because there are, yeah.
You know,
yeah.
The pilot changed his story, and I think the other aspect is that the pilot seems very, very accommodating in wanting to put his version of events across, regardless. But he seems to give different versions of the story to different organisations, as you've already touched on, which straight away raises my eyebrows, Keith, because when there's such an inconsistency, especially when, you know, they tried to recreate the possibility that one person could open a door of a plane, you know, flying at 4,000 feet above the English Channel, and it simply was unfeasible for one person to even do it, because the wind speed and the air pressure, it's a monumental task.
Yeah, it is. Well, the plane's travelling at, 120 miles an hour. So you imagine you're in a car travelling at that speed and try and push the door open while you see it. You're going to meet pressure as you're trying to open it, especially if the window's up. So it's a hell of a speed. But the thing about the doors on those Fokkers were they were just huge pieces of wood. So you're trying to, it's not just like a small door that you've got to bend down and crouch and get through. It was a huge door that you could actually step through. I think it was over 6 foot tall and about 4 or 5 feet wide. So it's a huge piece of wood that you're trying to push against 120 miles an hour of wind speed. So the thing was, an accident investigator went up and while the plane was being flown, he was tied with rope around his waist with two people holding him, and he flung himself at the door and he barely got it open 6 inches. So it makes you wonder how a man on his own, who, although he was in reasonable shape, he was not a large, powerful man, how he could have opened it on his own. It would be nearly impossible.
Yeah. I mean, I must admit, when I'm reading that section about the investigation, Keith, yeah. I mean, I'm thinking, what is this chap doing? Because he's literally running at the door trying to burst it open with two guys holding onto a piece of rope.
Well, I wouldn't have fancied doing it, I must admit. You just have to hope that they held onto the rope. It did show, though, that even running against the door, a reasonable size, fully grown adult, didn't budge the door hard. They'd opened it so that it would open out. But I think he must have known that the door wasn't going to open that much anyway. Otherwise, I think you're taking your life in your hands doing it. Because technically, he could have dragged the other two out with him.
Well, absolutely. You know, stranger things have happened, Keith.
My goodness.
There's some crazy things going on in those days of aviation, I have to say.
Yeah, I don't think they'd conduct an accident investigation like that today.
Thank God, I would suggest there, Keith. Yeah. I mean, it's one of those, because obviously, you know, this man, extremely rich, he seemed to have a marriage of convenience, shall we say. He was known as being not He had a bit of a personality where people could find him quite spiky. He was very determined, and you know, he was very business driven. So people would often point and say, "Oh well, he's probably upset everybody." However, he was noted to be rather generous with his staff. He would often give them bonuses, you know, that would be eye-watering amounts these days for, you know, without wishing to be disparaging to these people, you know, for essentially domestic servants. You know, these aren't people, you know, helping him make money. These are people who work under his for his house and his family.
Yeah, that's right. Yeah, the butler. I mean, his secretary was there, but there was two female stenographers as well. As you say, they were just support staff. They weren't directors of the companies that he had or anything like that. They were sort of close personal staff. But in fairness, he did look after them. He was known for being good to his staff. Mm. And the thing is, if you're going to, say, murder somebody of the six people that were there, everybody would have to be in on it.
Yeah.
They would have to. And even if they weren't in on it, if you take, say, the two female stenographers, they'd have had to have been threatened that if you open your mouth, you'll disappear or something. But so for a murder to have been committed, they all kept their mouths shut for the rest of their lives, basically.
Yeah. And the other aspect is that nobody really seems to be financially benefiting from this scenario, because that's always the case that, you know, none of the people who were on the flight seem to... That, because it's always often happens in certain cases where somebody's bumped off for financial reasons, Keith, and then all of a sudden, you know, a year later, somebody's got a wonderful house, or they go daft and buy a top of the range sports car or something. And there was none of those alarm bells.
There wasn't
ringing.
Any of that. No, there wasn't any of that. And that's the odd thing about it, is you would expect the stenographers to. Although nobody knows what happened to them, I'm sure that with a bit of digging, you could probably find out. But most of the people just carried on their lives as normal, if you like. There seemed to be no signs of sudden wealth being dumped on them. And the other thing about it is it couldn't have been really anybody on board that wanted to kill him, if you like. But he wasn't that much of a tyrant or somebody that was disliked, so that all six thought, yes, he really treats us like dirt. We're all going to kill him. You know, there didn't seem to be any of that. So if he was going to be murdered, it must have been somebody out with that sort of that group. But what was to be gained by it, other than say the threat of, if you open your mouth, oh, we'll kill you? Mm-hmm. It's a peculiar one.
It is as well, because, I mean, I think the pilot was probably the most recent addition to his staff as well, and he hadn't worked for him very long, had he?
No, he hadn't, no. But he was, obviously one doesn't want to impugn his character, but he was a pilot for Imperial Airways at the time, and his speciality was seaplanes, but he was deputised from Imperial Airways to... Where if you go through the early copies of Flight or the aviation magazines of that time, his name crops up pretty regularly, flying very wealthy people around, because the wealthy in the 1920s had plenty of cash and aviation was booming then, and everybody had to have their own aircraft, but not everybody could fly them. So he was in great demand from the wealthy to take them on safaris and flights out to Australia and India. So he was well known in those circles. And the odd thing about him, I think, is that he was reputed to be a bit of a womanizer in private. But in aviation circles, he was known to be quite tight-lipped. He wouldn't talk much about what he did or what he was doing, but the one thing that comes out in this case is he would talk to anybody who would listen to him. He gave several interviews, which for somebody who didn't like giving interviews, it seems a bit odd. But he died of cancer some years later.
Yeah, I mean, one of the theories was that he was having an affair with Lowenstein's wife, but then again, there doesn't seem to be any evidence that supports that at all, because they simply didn't have, I'm sure they could, but it seems remarkable that this chap would have the opportunity to seduce someone and create a murder plot in a matter of weeks.
It would have been a matter of weeks. It seems you wouldn't expect something like that to happen. If you've known somebody for 6 weeks, whether or not you're carrying on with them, it seems a very short period to be saying, look, if we murder this bloke who happens to be the world's richest man, we can have lots of money. But you see, he didn't end up with anything. Afterwards, he carried on being a pilot until he became ill with cancer. Yeah. So it's not even as if there was anything in it for him. And he certainly didn't. It's not like they left it for a little while and then he became engaged to her and the two of them married. That is, she moved to Paris and lived there on her own.
Yeah.
So it's... And the other thing about that particular theory about her, if you like, arranging his death, whilst it may have been a bit of a cold marriage, she wanted for nothing. Mm. It's not like she was kept in a garret at the top of one of their estates.
Yes.
She basically ran the estates and anything she wanted she had. So it seems a bit pointless to be killing him to have total control. It's not impossible, of course, but it's unlikely.
Yeah. I mean, it is, you know, like I say, it doesn't seem to have any of the ingredients of a crime of passion or a financial incentive. It's just a very, very perplexing case because clearly he didn't jump.
Yeah.
I doubt, I mean, you know, he wouldn't be the first person, Keith, and I'm sure, sadly, most of us in our lives have come across situations of friends or acquaintances that have taken their own life that to anybody on the outside that person would seem to be very well adjusted and doing okay.
Yeah.
And then occasionally, yes, you know, sadly these things happen. There doesn't seem to be that at all. That's not saying it didn't. However, once again, this, you know, the physical demands on Lowenstein to be able to even kill himself, once again, the door situation, the wind speed, makes that look highly unlikely. So you're only really left with the fact that he was thrown off.
Absolutely. But the other thing about the because a lot of people say it's obviously committed suicide somehow, but that all ignores the fact that he was a devout Catholic. It's a mortal sin to commit suicide. So that might not mean a lot to somebody who isn't a Catholic, but to a devout Catholic, that's quite important.
Mm.
And I put it in the book, as I say, he's a devout Catholic all his life, a totally devout Catholic, and he's about to commit a mortal sin by killing himself. And will he or will he not enter the kingdom of heaven?
Mm.
That's the bottom line on that. So again, that points to him not committing suicide. And the other thing about it is he was overheard making a phone call before he got on the plane to meet a Canadian businessman the following week.
Mm.
So if you're going to kill yourself in about an hour and a half's time, you wouldn't really be arranging to meet somebody a week later.
Yeah. It's a remarkable... I mean, it is a fantastic way to end the book. But like I say, it's a collection of five stories. And I think, to your credit as always, Keith, there are several very well-known aviation mysteries. And I think it's refreshing to see a collection that perhaps doesn't go after the obvious subjects as well. So I commend you on these five troubling stories that you've pulled together that aren't probably as well known as I mean, especially the Lowenstein one, because I think when you look at it through the prism of the late 1920s, he was one of the most important people in the world at that time.
He was. Well, thanks for your kind comments there, because I deliberately chose five stories that weren't... I mean, everybody goes on about the Bermuda Triangle, the planes that have disappeared. Yep. There, and the, you know, the Malaysian airline, the Boeing 777 disappearance. But I think there's every man and his dog has written books about those. I tried to go for something that stories that people would find interesting, that were still mysteries, but were perhaps lesser known. So, you know, but for that reason, people may not find them as interesting, say, as what happened to the Malaysian Airlines one. But I think in particular that Lowenstein story is, I don't think you can explain it other than murder. And even if he was murdered, He was taken to the door or attacked in by the door of the toilet in a space that wasn't a hell of a lot bigger than the old style phone boxes, and then pushed out of the door somehow. But it's incredible, but it seems to be the only explanation.
It's a fabulous collection, Keith, and like I said, yep. I commend you, and I recommend yep. it highly as your latest release. So I've read it once, and I know for a fact I'm going to dive into it, because I think it's one of those books that you need to keep rereading it just to keep picking up all the morsels and tidbits of information that you've included
yep.
in there.
Yep. Thanks very much. Thank you.
Hey, you're very welcome. So, Keith, as we touched on in the beginning, probably the case that's brought you to the most prominence, I suspect, over the last 10 years or so is your incredible ethics and work rate in regards to probably one of the most well-known mysteries, I think, in the world these days, which is Dyatlov Pass.
Yeah.
I mean, here we are, just gone past 61 years since the original incident.
Yeah.
You know, as we've mentioned, I think most people who are aware of the case know exactly how these people ended up where this tragic case occurred. So what was it that, you know, when you first came across it, Keith, were you surprised that it wasn't as well known as it is these days? Because I think it's one of those cases that just seems to have exploded once it's been dragged into the light in the West.
It's incredible, because my book was the first book in the West on it. And I can't remember the last count, there's about eight or nine at least,
yep.
with almost as many fiction, you know, non-fiction books, but there's also fiction books out on it. There's a couple of films in the making. I'm involved with somebody who's making a film about it as well mm-hmm. at the moment. As you say, it's literally just exploded. But I think what draws people to it, though, is the fact that it's another story that there's no single explanation that answers all the issues that are raised about it. You know, it's you can come up with any theory, but that no one theory fully works. I tend to stay off all the Dyatlov forums because for the simple reason that people get agitated when you. What I say, and I'm just updating my second book, but what I say is, whatever theory you've got, you should be able to stand, if you like, in a pretend court of law and have yourself subjected to criticism of your theory. And if you can't do that, you're wasting your time. You should be able to answer criticism, but nobody wants to hear criticism because I won't say too much about it, but somebody had contacted me about some photographs what this person had done was he put a lot of work into it. Though all the photographs taken by the group, or most of them, he said had been, they were forgeries basically, and he picked out a lot of things. And some of the things he picked out were actually, it made a good point. One of them was like he picked one photograph where somebody's shoe didn't appear to be on a ski. It was quite relevant, but there was a lot of the other points he was making that I felt weren't relevant. There's a picture of Yuri Yudin picking up Xena, whether they were mucking about, she'd fallen on the ground, he was picking her up, and he was saying this is a forged photograph because of the size of Yudin compared to Xena isn't right. And somebody had sent this to me, and I'd said, well, it's... you have depth in photographs and depth of perception, and photographs don't always tell you the truth. I mean, I know all this because a cousin of mine was a professional photographer, and he used to go to court in accident cases where there seemed to be, you know, where there was a dispute, usually insurance, and he would look at photographs and explain about depth of perception and what have you, and to say that a distance can appear to be much greater. Anyway, I'd said all this about this photograph, and the bloke replied with four-letter words and you fucking blah 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 and all the rest of it. And the point I'm making, I am making originally, is that you should be able to have your theory criticised.
Yep.
It's no good saying, because I'm going to insult you, my theory still stands.
Yes.
It's ridiculous. And by criticising the theories is the way you'll get your answers.
Yeah.
It's no good saying, I know about these things, or... I'm not listening to your criticism because this is definitely what happened. It doesn't stand up. And as I say, if it's in a court before a jury, does the jury decide you're right or not? I think that's the best way to look at it.
Yeah. I know exactly where you're coming from on that, Keith, because I actually I was on a Facebook group the other month, and this case came up. And as always, whenever this case appears, you're always the first person I think of, Keith.
Thank you.
This one chap was absolutely adamant it was an avalanche, and I just basically said precisely what your point there, Keith. I said, well, yeah, how does that explain such and such and such and such? And within two replies, it was all effing and jeffing, and you don't know anything. It's clearly an avalanche. That picture, and I said that the picture of the tent does not show evidence of an avalanche. If anything, it shows evidence of a slight snowfall, which you would expect in that area of Russia at that time of year.
Yeah. Well, I've stood at the point where that tent was. Mm. I've physically stood there and I've taken photographs. And there was, I think at that point, because I was with a large group, and there must have been about 10 of us had gone to the area of the tent whilst the others were further down on the tree line. And we all agreed, all of us, just looking up at the ridge, which was barely 30 feet away, you say, well, how in God's name could an avalanche have come down in that short distance? It couldn't have done.
Yeah, and I, as far as I believe as well, I think there's been over 100 similar expeditions to the area, and there's never been an avalanche sighted. Is that right?
That's right. Yeah, the thing with the Urals, they call it the Ural Mountains, but it's not like the Alps, say, or the Himalayas, with really steep, almost vertical cliffs in places, you know, on the mountains, but. In the Urals, it's much more gentle. I'm not saying that it's easy to get over them, it's hard ground, but it's much more, I won't say rolling hillside, but the mountains there are not particularly high compared to the Alps or whatever, but they're more gentle. They're more rolling features, if you like. So it's not avalanche country at all.
Yeah. And plus, you know, the fact was that Igor had actually led an expedition in the same area the previous year, I believe.
That's
as well.
Right.
He knew the area, he knew the terrain, he knew, you know, these were experienced people, as has been mentioned numerous times, Keith. You know, these were not rookies, unexperienced people. These were young, physically fit, experienced. I think they were known as sports tourists. It was that kind of.
They knew what they were doing.
Yeah.
Yeah.
It's. I think it's one of the other things as well. I think the other aspect that's muddied the waters about this case, obviously, is that infamous picture, Keith, that turned up of the snowman. Now, is that picture real? Because I've seen numerous people say this picture was created for a TV show, and I've seen other people say no, it's definitely real. And then once again, the other aspect is
according to. The negatives are with Yuri Konsevich, and it is real, but it's somebody, I can't remember who he said it, but I think it's Tebow, basically returning from having a Jimmy Riddle.
Yes.
Which, when you look at it, it does make a lot of sense.
Mm. Yeah, it looks like a man wrapped up for winter.
Yeah.
And I think, because I've seen numerous, I mean, the thing that always annoys me about this, because cryptozoology is one of my passions, Keith, and it's always annoying because people go, oh yeah, they were killed by yetis, and that always annoys me anyway because they're not called yetis there, but
no, the thing about I don't discount that theory anyway at all, because if you, and I've said this before in interviews, if you're standing at the Dyatlov Pass, you could walk from there to the peninsula, you know, where the Bering Straits are with Alaska. I mean, that's, what's that, about 2,800 miles. And if you could walk that in a straight line, obviously there'd be rivers and mountains on that path. But if you could walk it in a straight line, you wouldn't see another living person. It's so remote up there.
I mean, it's one of those things, like I say, I'm like you, Keith, because every time someone comes up with an explanation, you have to sort of forensically analyze it and say, right, does this stack up? And you know, the avalanche, fair enough, might have done, but there's no evidence of it happening in that
No.
area. The topography doesn't support that kind of thesis. The injuries to the nine doesn't seem
No,
to
no.
doesn't it doesn't stack up. And
It
then,
doesn't, no.
I mean, the one I probably gravitate towards more than anything is I personally, I'm of the belief they must have stumbled across something. Now, I don't know what they may have stumbled across or how it happened, but there clearly seems to have been some kind of physical altercation that's gone on. And I know people have said it was down to that the drunk person that they had an altercation with at the train station. It might have been revenge, but that once again seems a bit perplexing because there doesn't seem to be evidence, because you'd need a large group of people to be able to take down nine individuals, regardless of the fact that, you know, two of them were women. You know, these are still young, fit, and I would imagine, you know, in peak physical condition.
They were, yeah. No, it's as you say, something physical. It's the injuries to the chests of Zolotarev and Luda that are the things that really stand out. How could you get such a localized force to have crushed somebody's ribs like that, broken them?
I mean, it's one of those. I mean, it's one of those cases that where I remember the first time I watched. I think it probably was yourself, Keith, when you did. I think you did a whole episode for the Unexplained Files.
Yeah, I did, yes.
And I was. It was one of those, and I'm watching it. I'm thinking, right. And they opened up the investigation, and then they just closed it down within. Was it a couple of weeks?
Yes, it was just after the medical after the autopsies had been the report had been issued. It was closed down just after that. And what closed it down was the arrival of the Deputy Prosecutor General arrived from Moscow, and nobody seems to pay any attention to
Yes.
that Yurikov, and he just closed it down and took the case files away with him.
I mean, because the official party line, I suppose, was that is that, that these people was it that they just all died of hypothermia, and then the autopsies quite clearly
Well,
suggested, well, that wasn't true.
it's an awkward one because some obviously died of hypothermia, but you could say even the worst injured, the hypothermia could have caused the death. Possibly they could have survived even with such serious blows to the chest. You have to say, well, could they have survived had they been in, say, a normal temperatures with access to some kind of medical aid? But obviously the cold didn't help the seriously injured. Whatever. Whether they were injured or not, they'd have all succumbed to the severe temperatures anyway. To give some idea, and I've said this before in an interview, I remember, I think it was last winter, I think it was -8 or something. I actually went outside in my bare feet, and I'm not joking, it was absolutely freezing. And I thought, well, how did they cope when it was -27 in snow with barely with nothing on their feet? And you know, the cold attacks all of you, but obviously the heat really escapes through your feet, so they wouldn't have lasted long.
No. I mean, it's such a perplexing case, primarily because there are just so many strands of strangeness, you know, from the slits in the tent, which I believe the tent was recovered and disappeared,
Disappeared.
never and it's never been rediscovered.
In fairness, I suppose you could say, well, who wants a tatty old tent?
Yes.
police matters there were probably not as rigorous as they might have been over here. You know, I watch a lot of these detective shows on the TV, and people, you know, like an unsolved murder, if you like. There'll still be all the evidence from, say, a murder committed in 1978. So they'll still have all the evidence stored away. But I suppose in Russia in 1959, it was obviously perhaps not as rigorous as it could have been. But at the end of the day, it's basically a police investigation more than anything. That's why I always bring up the analogy of a court, or how would this police evidence look if you presented it in a court? And that's what I try and ask people to look at. I favour the military theory, but yeah, I can't make those facts fit, even with that.
I mean, that's the one I, like I say, I tend to suspect that they stumbled across something they weren't supposed to see, and you know, and with the greatest respect, you know, the Russian authorities were not the only country at that time under, you know, undertaking secret tests. You could say that about the UK government, America, China. Everybody had their own secret projects at the time. You know, it was the height of the Cold War, Keith. So,
It was,
you know.
and you know, the thing about it is, people might say, "Well, the government are covering things up." But just if I can digress for one quick minute, I was quite interested in aviation matters, as we discussed, and the BEA Comet crashed in over the Mediterranean. They'd taken off from Cyprus, you know, British European Airways. So the equivalent of, I don't know, of what be British Airways 7 A320 now, if you like. But in 1968, it took off from Cyprus on its way to stop at Athens, on its way to London, exploded in midair. Now, the Metropolitan Police went out there. Some of the files in the National Archives have been released about the bombing, but there's two, I think, or three files which were closed until 2044, and they've just been extended to 2070 by the British government. So you think, what is it in those files that, you know, to do with the Metropolitan Police investigation that are so contentious, if you like? A plane explodes in midair, everybody's killed, a British airliner, and yet the files are sealed till 2070, extended, the period's been extended, so that anybody who would have been connected with it will be dead. So you think, well, what are they hiding? So, because people tend to blame the Russian government, you know, well, they're all secretive, blah blah blah, they won't say anything, but that's the way the Russians are. But the British government are being quite secretive about something that happened to a British airliner, so it's just the way they are.
Oh, absolutely. I think it is one of those things, Keith. It's very easy to go, oh, yes, you know, that's what Russia did. But, you know, as you quite rightly surmised there, everybody does it.
Yeah, they do. They do.
You know, keep inconvenient truths covered up, I think, is often the
Well,
case when it comes to government
it's
at that level.
I think the bottom line is it's embarrassment. You're
Yes.
going to embarrass somebody. That's why a lot of these things happen. A bit like the old files on the old Christine Keeler, but that's digressing a bit.
Yes,
You know, that whole affair in Profumo. Why can't we see what's in the files? But it's, I think, but most of it. Well, there's two things. One is embarrassment, and the other one is some kind of financial claim. But either way, it's shameful, in my opinion.
Absolutely, absolutely. I think it is one of those things. I mean, the other aspect of this story, Keith, I think, did you expect to become so embroiled in it? I mean, obviously because you've been out there several times. I think you went for the 60th anniversary last year, did you not? With
Well,
and
no, I got my visa three days after I was due to come back from it. Yeah, talk about frustration. But I did raise the not the well, you know, the majority of the funds in when we in 2018. Because I keep in close touch with Yuri Konsevich at the Atlov Foundation, and he was discussing with me about the possibility of getting the case reopened, because we had an affidavit from Doroshenko's sister of the right of the close relatives and the families to a proper outcome, proper in the, to for it to be properly investigated, and a proper outcome that would satisfy the families was the base of it. And we made an approach to the Human Rights Commission in Russia, but they said that it wasn't really their jurisdiction. They didn't want to get involved. But anyway, I raised the funds through GoFundMe, and I will say on anybody here listening, there must have been over 30 people contributed, including a businessman in Tennessee who wants to remain anonymous, but he contributed the largest amount and said there was more there if we needed it, which is very decent of him.
Wow.
It was very decent, because there was a rather scurrilous article on the internet called From Russia with Doubt at the time. I won't say who was responsible for it, but again, it comes back to this I'm an expert and I know everything attitude, who said that we were wasting people's money. But we got the case reopened in the end, and whether or not it's going to be satisfactory, and unfortunately I don't think it will be the outcome, but at least it was reopened. So
yeah, well, I mean, I was going to say that, because I know they made quite a there was quite a fanfare made. I think, was it last year that they decided to reopen the case, Keith?
Yes, yeah.
So is the case is currently still open and allegedly being investigated?
It is, but with the coronavirus over there now, everything's... I'm hoping to go over again when all this finishes, but God knows when that will be, because I want to go back up to the past for those couple of ideas I've got. I wanted to see if I could take a drone up with me, because I think that'd be quite good to get some shots with a drone. But Russia being what it is, it's not the easiest place to be taking stuff like that in, if you like.
Yeah, yeah. I think one of the aspects that made me chuckle, I think, is that I think when you went back one summer, it was essentially a mud bath there as well, wasn't it? It's such a remarkably tough area to go at any time of the year, it seems.
It's awful. well, put it this way, if you think you could drive up there in a four-wheel, you'd actually walk to from the village of Ushma, which is the nearest village, really, to the base of the mountain, the Mansi village of Ushma. If you were to walk from there, although we were in one of those giant Russian trucks, which took us a good bit of the way along, but you would probably get there faster if you walked, rather than going even in a four-wheel drive, because I injured my knee there, and there were some hunters brought me back. They were very kindly, but they had one of these all singing, all dancing vehicles with all mod cons on board. We went over some really bad rocks, and they repaired it with all the kit on board. They had compressed air and everything, but something underneath the truck had been badly damaged by the rocks. It's like a kind of a lunar landscape in places, but the mud is terrible. I remember getting stuck in it at one point. When we were going up there, and my foot, it's like quicksand.
Yeah.
And one of the guides actually had to help pull me out because I was stuck fast. I couldn't move. So and yet you still get the odd thing I thought about it is when we were driving back, we would come across people on their own. We came across one guy who was he had a huge pack on his back. With obviously a giant tent, all the accessories, binoculars and cups and flasks hanging off it. We said, are you okay? Do you want a lift? He said, no, I'm fine. But in the summer up there, you've got bears wandering all over the place and wolver. It's not a place, you can't get a mobile signal either. So it's not a place you'd want to come unstuck in on your own. And yet he wasn't the only person we saw. And they weren't Mansi either. The Mansi obviously live in the area and know it well. These were hikers. Strange.
Yeah, I mean, it does seem to be one of those areas that does attract strangeness, Keith. And I think
because the
case is so compelling as well, because, you know, I mean, the other aspect of this, and I think this is one of the things that often gets overlooked, is that, you know, the families of the nine victims are still searching desperately for answers. You know, for the best part of six decades, they've just felt completely ignored and excluded from this, and that must be really hard to reconcile. That, you know, your brother, your son, as far as the authorities are concerned, it seems like they don't care, and that must be awful for them to have to deal with this on a day-to-day basis.
Yeah, I think in communist times, you were wise to just, if you were told shut up, you just shut up. But you think the trouble is, I don't want to say too much, obviously, because I hope to get my visa again, but Russia seems to have gone down the authoritarian path again. Mm. There's new laws coming in where anybody who'd served in the military can't really talk about it for fear of imprisonment. So it's not like over here, if you've been in the RAF or the Navy, you could write a book of memoirs about it, obviously not writing about top secret stuff. But over there, it's a different kettle of fish.
Yeah, it's a quick way to lose your freedom, I think.
Well, and worse, but but it is a shame. I mean, the only time that I think that something might have come out of it was when Yeltsin was in power, because he I know Gorbachev started it all off, but when Yeltsin came to power, he seemed to want to try and make amends, if you like. Mm. You know, there was a bit about the royal family who've been shot in.
Yeah.
You know, and their remains brought up and given them a decent funeral and all this type of thing. But and also there was the anthrax, I've mentioned it in interviews before. He allowed Americans to come in to investigate the outbreak of anthrax there from a military facility.
Yeah.
But that story now has gone back to the original one about contaminated meat when it wasn't. The whole thing is going back to the way it was, unfortunately. Mm. And with that type of attitude, you're not going to get any real answer, I don't think. Mm. Unfortunately.
Yeah. Is it? I think it's also one of those cases. I think that new evidence does seem to occasionally pop up, Keith. Because I think I mean, when was the first time you sort of looked into this, really? Oh. And was it sort of the late 2000 and noughties?
I think it was 2010 when I first came across it.
Mm.
So 10 years ago now.
Yeah.
I had had it mentioned to me a little bit before that, because the way I came across it was I'm quite into Soviet military history and Soviet aviation. So there was somebody that had mentioned it to me, because that's one of the theories, if you like. But one thing I am doing in my updated to my second book is a theory that's come, funnily enough, from an old acquaintance, if you like, who went to work in the USA for, he became head of research for a major American, a major US defense contractor.
Mm.
And he read a lot of papers, research papers, coming out of the Warsaw Pact countries in the 1960s. And they were way ahead, a good bit ahead of the West in sensors and research on radar, stuff like that.
Mm.
And his view is that, and I've put it in the book, that the Russians were experimenting with airborne platforms, probably helicopter-based, using double rotors, and that they were using sensors, because in those areas are so huge, you can't really cover it visually, so the sensors would pick up what was on the ground, and mentioning in particular the stove that they had, the gas, which was all metal. So you got a group of people close together with a large piece of metal which looks peculiar. That was his thinking behind it, but it's quite interesting.
Yeah.
So.
I mean, the other aspect, I mean, you've touched on it there, I think one of the other aspects that often gets brought forward as an explanation is that they all suffer from carbon monoxide poisoning because of this stove. But is there any evidence to support that at all, Keith?
No, I don't see how, because the stove was put away, and some of them were outside the tent taking pictures. So if you're suffering from carbon monoxide poison, you're not going to be thinking, well, we'll go and take some pictures of something odd happening in the night sky. That's my life. I don't want to get it's a theory, and I don't want to ridicule it. That's the thing.
Yes.
But to me, what happened that night has something to do with what was going on in the sky. It's too much of a coincidence for it not to have been, I think.
Yeah.
But it's finding out exactly what that was in the sky why they were interested in it as opposed to it being a meteorite or something else. It obviously drew their attention, and then they're all dead at the end of it. So,
yeah, because I think is it the last two or three photos that were recovered, Keith? So that show these strange lights
In my second book, one of the researchers that works with the foundation, Valentin Yakimenko, he analysed all the slides, removed any dirt or anything that might have not been on the film itself, and he's come up with quite a few interesting clips. But what I'm putting into the new book is somebody in Hungary who has really gone into it, and his view is that it's a rocket breaking up. And I've asked his permission to include his analysis of it in the book, which he's kindly agreed to. S. Z. Talker is how he wants to be known. He doesn't. There's one thing about Dyatlov is nobody really wants to give their names. he's done an absolutely amazing job on it. Mm. Even to show where the heat is in the rocket, and you can see how he applies it to these stills. Mm. So it's quite interesting. But again, you see, even if it was a rocket, it wouldn't have had a warhead. Yeah. It comes down to the ground. So why do they think there's, you know, if you go follow the rocket theory, do you think there's going to be more rockets? It's just one rocket. They're taking a few pictures. Why would you run away from the tent down to the bottom of the hill to the tree line to certain death, basically, just because a rocket falls down, if that's what it was? Yeah. Again, it doesn't make sense. You've got to try and work it through.
Yeah, I mean, as well as obviously there are a selection of photos taken of the scene after the investigations turn up, and there doesn't seem to be any kind of evidence of an impact or anything.
There doesn't. No, I mean, the whole place was closed down afterwards for 4 years, so you could say, well, were they clearing up? But there were so many searchers there, you'd think some of them would have said, well, spoken out of turn and said, well, I saw a large fin sticking out of the snow about 100 yards from the tent, but nobody said anything about rocket parts or whatever. But could it have been that they got covered with snow? And there's also another, again, going into the theories that they died somewhere else and were brought, the whole scene was set up. So,
which is,
it's like a maze. You keep running in, isn't it? You keep running into one dead end after another.
Yeah, well, that's it. I think that's the intriguing thing about this case is every possible solution seems to fall down on certain aspects. And it's not a one-size-fits-all. And I've always admired the fact that since you brought this case to people's attention, Keith, you've been very accommodating, because I would imagine you still get people contacting you saying they've solved it, no doubt.
Oh, all the time. I actually, in fairness, I had to take my I have a dedicated Dyatlov website. I've had to take my email address off it purely because of I was getting anything up to 60 emails a day. Yeah, and you know, you want to do the decent thing and answer everybody, but it was taking all my whole. I was using up all my spare time just out, and I had to take it up because I don't have time to answer everything. Mm. And that's not to say people are contacting me with rubbish. They're not. I've found quite a few people that have contacted me come out with some very good points. Mm. Well, there was one person contacted me from he's at university in the USA. Mm. And he made quite a valid point. He said, the only thing, it seems to me, is that I wouldn't walk to the bottom from safety to the bottom of a snowy mountain in sub-zero temperatures unless I was at the point of a gun. And I thought that was quite a telling comment. But the other thing about it, about people saying, I've solved this, if you think how many people know about this mystery, if you like, just pick up something out of the air, like 300,000 people worldwide, and that's everybody putting their brains into it. I've had a distinguished, although I know him through somebody else personally, but a distinguished professor of chemistry has been, has discussed it with me. People of brainier than I am, but with so many clever people coming together, and you still can't come up with the correct answer. Thousands of people, you think you could pick something from all the various theories, but you just can't do it, can you?
No, it is remarkable, and I think, like you just touched on there, the amount of correspondence you were getting, Keith, the appetite for the case is phenomenal.
It is, yeah. I reckon we'll probably see a few more films on it. What I'd like to see is a film that faithfully follows the story of them, you know, a period 1959 film with everything as accurate as they can get it, which follows one of the theories, but not, I mean, I don't mind Rennie Harlin as a director, but I don't think he did a very good job with his work. it was the ending that ruined it. The actual theory of having some young Americans trying to find out what had happened, in theory, it's not a bad thing, is it? It's as a storyline, but it just, to me, it got a bit, I think it could have found a far better ending to it, but there's such huge scope for it. I think there's room for another couple of, at least another couple of films with different endings on it. But I'd like to see something that concentrates on the actual journey, with people playing each person and keeping it to 1959, but and coming up with a good ending that's plausible.
I think the other aspect, I think, before I let you escape, is the fact that the chap whose back went and had to go. I mean, it must, the ramifications of that, Keith, is that chap, for the rest of his life, you know, regardless of, I know people have pointed the finger of suspicion towards him as well, obviously, is that he would have had to have lived with the ramifications of escaping death, regardless of what happened to his, you know, his hiking mates.
Yeah.
He would have had to have lived with that for the rest of his life, knowing one way or the other, if he'd not had a bad back, he wouldn't have, you know, obviously he probably would have died as well.
He would have done. I don't see that he would have escaped. Yuri Udin, but to my eternal regret, he lived, over the other side of the Urals, and the first time I went there, they said Yuri Udin's coming over on Saturday. Would you like to meet him? And I said I would like to meet him very much as the sole survivor. But I had my visa ran out on the Friday, so I left on the Friday. He was coming over from Solikamsk on the Saturday, and what I said to Yuri Konsevich was, "I'll see him on my next trip," which you do.
Yes.
Thing. And of course he died not that long after, and sadly he wasn't in the greatest of health, but it's just a pity I didn't actually get to meet him. I think Donny Iker met him when he was over there, but I had the chance. But like I say, it's I think you should grab the opportunities when they present themselves, because to say you'll see somebody next time, I mean, quite just digressing again another second, so a friend of mine sadly caught cancer, and he only, from his diagnosis, although he didn't know it, he had 17 days left to live.
Yes.
I was actually going to go up and see him the following weekend, when he died on the Friday, but I thought, well, no, I'll go up this Saturday, and managed to at least see him, but he didn't last to the following, because that's, and that's happened to me a couple of times, not people dying necessarily, but I think you should grab opportunities when they're there, certainly.
Yeah, very much so, yeah, that's something I sadly can concur with. It's one of those things, and I think, even especially in the current climate, Keith, I think we should all take the opportunity to speak to people we haven't, and reach out and do as much as we possibly can, because right now you just don't know what might happen.
You don't know, literally.
So, as you touched on, Keith, so are you going to be releasing an updated version of your second book?
I'm hoping to have it out within the next 2 weeks. I've got a chapter. The thing is, I don't want people buying it who bought the second book already. But basically, it's an upgrade. There's a couple of new chapters. I put in a chapter on the Mansi. I've been in touch with a Mansi professor who's given me a lot of very useful information, which interestingly opens up the Mansi theory. But I've included the work from the Hungarian Eszed Tóker about his analysis of the rocket, which, as I say, I think people will find very interesting. And a bit more about getting the case reopened and what have you. So it'll probably add about a third to the book, but I don't particularly want people buying it who've bought it already. Otherwise you'll get people saying, well, you cheated me, and I've already read this first bit, because the second book was just about my journey up to the pass. I thought people might find that interesting, but what people have criticised it for is they wanted to see more theories. But to me, there's enough out there about the theories in books. I mean, like I say, however many there are now, which cover all the theories, you can go on to any forum and that covers all the theories. And I just thought it might be, from an armchair traveller's point of view, it might interest people to see what it was like to describe what it was like to travel up there and describe it while I was there. So anyway, yep.
Well, fabulous. I look forward to it. I'll certainly be purchasing one of those
That's very
kits.
kind. Yeah, I'll give you the nod anyway. I'm hoping to have it. There's a lot of work to do with the pictures and what have you. I'm putting a lot more pictures in it. So I reckon it'll take me about 2 weeks more, and then I'll have it up on Amazon.
Fabulous. Well, I wish you the very best of luck
Thank
again
you.
with that
Thanks.
re-release, Keith. So, where can everybody keep up to date with your work and follow
Uh,
your
well, I've
fantastic
got
resources?
I've got two websites, and one's Keith McCloskey, author, if you type that in, and the other one is Dyatlov Pass Incident. What I'll do, because I don't have, well, excuse me, foolish of me, if I send you the links, maybe you could
I will
put
include them
them.
in my. I always include the show notes, Keith, so
Yeah.
I'll point everybody in the right direction. So if
Thank you.
anybody wants to do that, they can just click on the show notes and go directly to your website. So I'll include
Great.
those for you, and I'll also have a link to your Amazon page for your work as well. Because, like I say, your latest book, Unsolved Aviation Mysteries, is a cracking read. I recommend it highly.
Thank you very much.
It's food for thought. Like I say, the Lowenstein. The case, I think, bears a striking resemblance to the murder on the Orient Express, I think, because
Yeah.
it's one of those where you
Well, the
just,
same period,
yeah,
isn't it? Yeah.
it's very true.
Yeah.
So listen, Keith, it's been a real pleasure. Like I said to
Yep.
you at the
Oh,
beginning,
it's
I've
been
been
great
one.
talking to you, Paul. Thank you.
Oh, my pleasure. You're always welcome. I wish you the best of luck with the updated version. It's
Lovely.
been a real pleasure. I'm really glad to finally have a chance to speak to you properly. And you're always welcome back. And I wish you the very best of luck. You take care.
Yeah, thank you very much, Paul.